described as eloquent, moving, meditative. Let's talk about Laura Levitt's latest work, The Objects That Remain. It gets its motivation from the rape of author, scholar Laura Levitt. So we start strong some three decades ago. I know hopefully it never gets old, but I hope you're doing well, Laura.
I am. Thank you so much
for that, because we talk reality. The Objects That Remain, of course, written by you, professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University in the great city of, Philadelphia, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, author also of American Jewish Loss After the Holocaust and Jews and Feminism. So good writings you do. But yet this one is a bit different, may I ask, Laura?
Yes, it is. It's written in a much more writerly style, and it's pitched at a much broader audience. And that was a purposeful act, and I really hope that the book reaches a broader audience.
Thank you for that. The Objects That Remain. Let's talk about a bit of the plot, obviously, the memory. Take me back to 1989.
Okay. It was November of 1989. It was actually the first Tuesday of November of that year, and I was home alone in my apartment in Atlanta. I was a graduate student at Emory University, actually studying Jewish and Christian theology. And, I heard I was watching television. I think I was exercising in the living room. And I heard a sound, but, you know, like you hear sounds. And so I got up and I started looking around the apartment. And, I pulled back the curtain in the bathroom. And I remember I walked into my bedroom and I looked around and I kind of turned around. And all of a sudden, a strange man jumped out of the closet and attacked me. It was a nightmare. So he choked me and he raped me, and I was fortunate to get out. That's what happened.
Thank you for that. And yes, some three decades ago. Your book is described as part personal memoir, as mentioned, yet fascinating examination, of the ways in which the material remains of violent crimes inform our experience of and thinking about trauma and loss here?
Absolutely. So I'm so glad that you brought that connection back. Mm. This book really was generated by my learning about the material evidence from another woman's crime, the murder of Jane Mixer, the aunt of the writer, Maggie Nelson. I met Maggie Nelson, and Maggie Nelson had written about her aunt and her aunt's life and her death. She never met this woman. And then as her book went to press, there was a break in what was then an over 30-year-old cold case, and it was DNA evidence. And when I met Maggie, she had been just been to a preliminary hearing, and lo and behold, saw the clothes that her aunt was wearing the night that she was murdered. And I have to say, hearing that story about another woman's clothing brought me back to the scene of my crime. And all of a sudden, I hadn't even occurred to me to think about the clothing that I wore that night. And at the same time, I was writing about Holocaust memory. And so I began to think about what is in police storage, what are the material objects there, and then what are the material objects held in places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I wanted to think about what work they do. And so that's what set me on this journey.
Yes. Material artifacts not only provide a sense of continuity, you write, offering us a tangible proof that we're the same people we were before. They also allow us to make connections to others, even invite conversation. In what ways, if you can expand?
Well, it's a little bit like the story I just told, which is all of us can relate to, our clothing, and to see something that was an ordinary object that, you just take for granted, and all of a sudden it becomes something else because it's been brushed by violence. And I think that that occasions other people to think about their objects and their stories. And so my hope is that by telling my story, I encourage other people to think about their experiences, because the truth is, the experience of violence is a very lonely business, and there is just something very powerful about feeling recognized and recognizing oneself in someone else's writing or creative work. So I write also about works of art as well that that are generative. And so my hope is that those conversations open up and that more of us can be recognized. And I think of this as a form of really doing justice.
Yes. Laura, you talk about this. There's a photo of the of a blue and white striped, what, prisoner's uniform near the front of your book labeled Artifact. What does this go into detail here, I guess?
All right, so the image at the very beginning of the book is from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and it is a prisoner uniform that's being attended to by conservators at the museum. And I talk about how that that prisoner uniform brings us back to that time and that place and tells us something about the people who wore them. And the ways in which we think about the memory of the Holocaust through objects, because they are often the traces that we have, and especially when we think about Holocaust memory in the present time as survivors are aging and have become increasingly frail, the material objects are some of the most precious evidence that we have that connects us to that time and that place in the here and now.
Laura, you had not considered the disposition of your evidence since the rape back in 1989. Again, 25 years later, this was in 2014. Did you file a formal request for information? If you did, what did you expect to find here?
Yes, I'm glad you asked about this. I did file an official request in the summer of 14, and I did not expect to find anything. And in fact, I had imagined the book for a long time as having a final chapter that said nothing's left, right? Nothing remains. But in point of fact, I put in that request. I waited a couple of months, and then I ended up making a cold call to the Atlanta police. And over the course of being, you know, of that call, I was sent to one person to another, and finally I got to someone in sex crimes, a sergeant there, who said, "Funny you should call. I have your case file on my desk, and we've been looking for your evidence." And although they were never able to find that evidence, what she was able to do was to tell me, she answered all my questions about the fact that the Atlanta police did retest DNA evidence from the 80s even, in the early 2000s. She told me a lot about what they do, and it was a very powerful conversation. And I got off the phone. I was just so flabbergasted by the whole thing. I had forgotten to realize that she had my case file. Mm. So I immediately wrote back to her, and I said, would it be possible for me to get a copy of that file? And that's how I got the file. And that is not nothing, right? It is actually a very important and powerful document.
Lastly, before we obviously share how to find out more information about the objects that remain, Laura, throwing around more dates, 1992, after Anita Hill's testimony at Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court confirmations hearings, what, your mom discussed your rape with then-Senator Joe Biden?
Yes, she did. I'm from Dover, Delaware, and Delaware, as you know, is a small state. And my parents were very close to Joe. You didn't have to be wealthy. My mother was a school teacher. My father worked for the Social Security Administration. And they were big Joe supporters and would go to these seminars at his house every month. And so when he was working on the Violence Against Women Act, my mother asked for my permission, and she talked to Joe about it. And I told her that if he had wanted me to testify, that I would do that.
Take-home message from your latest work, Laura?
You don't have to be alone, and it's important to tell your stories to the people that you need to tell them to, and to trust yourself.
For your time and conversation, the objects that remain, how do we find out more information?
I have a new website. It's Laura Levitt, all one word, LauraLevitt.org, and I would be delighted to have people check it out.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing your story.